You are listening to a sermon by Jody Sparger, recorded on Sunday, September 1st, 2019 at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thank you. It's good to be with you guys. I was last here in 1999. That summer I was working with the Navigators, and we used your space here for a summer program and would do all sorts of exciting. In fact, I remember very clearly packing for 5 days on the Juan de Fuca Trail in this room in particular. But we had opportunity to worship with you guys on occasion during that summer as well. Rosie and I were classmates at Regent College, so it's fun to kind of keep track of you through her over the years as well. So it's good to be back. I'm just going to offer one point of correction on the work that I do in Healing at the Wounding Place, that it is with First Nations people, but that it's not primarily about the healing there. It's the healing between, I think you said, Indigenous people of faith. That's not necessarily the case. It's people of faith who are largely non-Indigenous, and Indigenous peoples, some of whom are people of faith, and some of whom practice their own spirituality, some of whom are nowhere on that journey. So it's being neighbors with Indigenous neighbors and breaking down some of the laws, the walls of separation and practical apartheid that we live in this country. And that is what I want to turn to with you all. This question of, and you guys have, you've had an interesting history of talking with a variety of folks about right relations with First Nations people. My friend Steve Heinrichs has been here and spent time with you all and others along the way. And so I know this isn't new stuff for you, but I wanted to reflect on some of the learnings that have been happening for me and some of the people who I'm on this journey with, in ways that might strengthen and encourage and refine our focus as we move forward. And Ed, I'm gonna have a, I have a warning for you. So I don't stay contained very well behind a pulpit. But if you can't hear me at any point, just let me know, because I will drift away from your device. What are pathways to reconciliation? How might we walk this journey in a long way, in a sustained way? How might we be moving forward out of this legacy of having come through a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, after which many Indigenous folks said, well, some truth was told, but the reconciliation piece, that is yet to be seen. Will this unfold into transformation? And for many Indigenous people, what I hear over and over again is, please don't use the word reconciliation for a couple of reasons. One, can we reconcile if we were never conciled? If there was never a relationship, how do we get back to a relationship that didn't exist? That's an important question in our context. I think theologically there's some reason to use language of reconciliation, because in the imagination of God and in the reality of God's kingdom, there is conciliation with all peoples, but that is a valid critique in our context today. And the other piece that I hear from them is, please don't use the word reconciliation until things have started to change substantially for Indigenous peoples. So we do lots of, we talked about the blanket exercise. It is a powerful learning experience. If you haven't done it, I'd encourage you to just have your ears open for where and when you might be able to have that experience. But many of us walk away from learning experiences feeling like our lives have been transformed. Our perspectives have been utterly and completely changed. And Indigenous people would say, that's great, but please don't then say you are working, you've walked into reconciliation. Reconciliation is happening just because you have a different understanding of things. Reconciliation will require substantial changes to the dynamics that continue to oppress Indigenous peoples even to this day. But for those of us who are sensitive to those things and want to listen well and be responsive to those kinds of things, it can become a little terrifying to know, how do we move forward? What steps should we take that are the right steps? How do I not continue in patterns of fixing when fixing is what got us in the problem in the first place? How do we walk this out well? And it's interesting, I've heard this more from non-Indigenous people than from Indigenous folks who are well-intentioned, who say, really, what is the solution? What is the answer? Are we supposed to just go home to the places we came from and give Indigenous people back their land? And I don't know what home I might go back to. As Mennonites, that might be particularly true for you, right? At which stage in the journey is home back in some other country? I've only once in writing and never in person encountered an Indigenous person who's ever said, go home, that's the solution. So it's interesting that what framework of that in us is revealing of our own anxieties about what this journey and path might mean and look like. There is, in fact, deep anxiety that comes up as we have these conversations. Have you all experienced that? It occurs to me that what lies beneath the surface of these questions, the anxieties that those of us who are settlers have, is really a question of identity. It's a question of who we are in the story and figuring out what is our role to play. This was super instructive for me a number of years ago as I sat at an ecumenical advocates circle as we prepared for the Vancouver TRC event. And Commissioner Marie Wilson said to this gathered group of clergy, largely, she said, you guys see yourselves as the rescuers, as the ones with reconciliation to bring to this situation. But you need to understand that this is a legal proceeding. And in this legal proceeding, you are the accused. Well, that was hard for a lot of us to hear, right? I don't know how I feel about that being my role in the story. Of course that produces some anxiety. I long to be a reconciler. I long to be a rescuer. As Paul mentioned, since he already took the cat out of the bag, I'm an American originally. I'm a Baptist. And so I sat in circles listening to residential school survivors' stories, seeing myself as separate because I'm not Canadian. I wasn't here when that happened. I'm a Baptist. We didn't run schools, right? I can be a kind and friendly bridge building arbiter of peace and reconciliation. And then my friend, remember that thing about mentors who kick your butt being the ones who are the best for you? Chief Bobby Joseph, who some of you maybe had occasion to hear or see, he pulled me aside and he said, Jody, you see yourself as being really separate from everyone else here. He said, but you need to understand that people who looked like you and people who said they loved Jesus like you came into our communities and did horrible things in the name of Jesus. But here's the critical part of what he said. He said, if there aren't people who look like you and who love Jesus like you, who will walk out the whoop and wharf of this story, if there aren't people who will own that, there can be no reconciliation. There can be no healing. There's no one with whom to be reconciled. Will you help be someone with whom that reconciliation can happen by taking on that identity of those who looked like you and sounded like you? It's a powerful invitation. And the story of reconciliation, as we know, doesn't end with just resolving the legacy of residential schools. But that was the critical point for us as a nation to come to terms with, that we are a different nation knowing what we know now than we were 10 years ago. But who are we in the story still? There's an aspect of being the accused that's important for us to take on. How do we let that sustain us? How do you stay in the story, taking on that role of the accused? How might that happen and change things? Let's come to our text, the Lucan text. Critical part of this text got left out in the printout. You might have noticed it stopped in the middle of a sentence, and I made numerous errors in transmitting what the passage was prior to today, and so I double-checked to see if that was another error I had committed, but that one wasn't mine. But it builds the anticipation of this moment. So in the Lucan story, we have Jesus showing up in the synagogue. He reads that famous passage from Isaiah 61. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, right? To pronounce all of these wonderful things. Today in your hearing, this has been fulfilled. And what do the people in the gathered congregation, what do they have to say? They say, ah, that Jesus, isn't he Joseph's son? He's grown up to be such a nice guy. Sort of the response after that bit. Then Jesus sits down. And then he starts to talk about some other stuff. Now, I rarely have heard a sermon on both of these texts. Mostly we divide this right here because it's super confusing to hold these things together. So, we're going to try and hold them together. Not because I think I'm that smart, but because I think there's something important in that tension and in the confusion for us. So then he goes on to say, truly I tell you, prophets aren't accepted in their hometowns. And then he gives these two examples from Elijah and Elisha's ministries of them being them bringing healing in the case of Elisha to Naaman, to an outsider, right? Naaman the Syrian. And then in the case of Elijah, that even though there were righteous people in Israel, Elijah has to go to the widow of Zarephath in order to receive hospitality and care, right? So Jesus, who is being well received in the synagogue as he sits down from his reading of the Isaiah text, then begins to agitate and stir the pot. And here's the part that we missed. So let's, starting with verse 28. It's really just two verses, verses 28 and 29. All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard these things about the widow of Zarephath and about the healing of Naaman. They got up and they drove Jesus out of town. They took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him off the cliff. What just happened? Right? I was last year to this hill, to the cliff where they were going to throw him off. Let me just say that this wasn't just like a heated church debate that then you go outside and you sort it out. This actually required them to go a long way to get Jesus to that cliff, right? This was sustained mob behavior that suddenly gets unleashed with this naming of these two innocuous stories of Elijah and Elisha. What is going on here? What causes this extreme anxiety? I wonder if that anxiety comes out of challenging and questioning the identity of the people gathered in the synagogue that day. If that anxiety comes from questioning who they are and what their role is in the story. And if for all of us, when our identity is challenged, we kind of lose, you know, the frontal cortex functioning in our brains and we go a little crazy. It seems like the people are ready to receive this message that the day has arrived when the poor will receive good news, when the oppressed will be liberated, the prisoner set free, that they see themselves as those people in the story. And this liberation, they have waited a long time for it. This oppression is clear to them all around as they look outside of their doors at the Roman soldiers walking down the street. They believe themselves to be those awaiting liberation in this moment. But then Jesus talks about them as though they aren't the ones waiting to be liberated, as though they are perhaps actually the bad guys in the story. Nobody wants to be the bad guy in the story. As though Jesus might need, like Elijah and Elisha, to go beyond the chosen people of God in order to find and exercise the ministry that should be the right of the people of God. And it sends them into a rage. That agitation reveals something about their identity, right? You ever had your identity challenged? So, in all kinds, or your credentials, or any number of things, right? Things that we cling to that we say, this is who I am, and this is why I'm important. And there are some times when you can challenge those things, and it doesn't, you can have them challenged, it doesn't matter at all. Because you are so certain in that identity that I don't care what you say, it's going to be all right. Right? I know that this is true of me. At Regent, I used to avoid taking classes from new professors, right? Because new professors had a lot of anxiety about their own credentials. And they were far less generous graders as a consequence. Not that I was trying to protect my GPA or anything, but more that there was a sense that when I worked with some of the older professors, I found something being pulled out in me. I found myself reaching for greater potentials that were in me, and I found myself embattled with the validity of the identity of myself versus the professor when I was working with someone who was a little less certain about that identity. We've all had some version of that experience, right? So if our identity is really solid, it doesn't matter what questions come to it, but when our identity is maybe a little insecure, then we are going to flash in the pan a little faster as our anger rises in reaction to questions of our identity. What does all this have to do with reconciliation and covenant relationship in particular? This So a friend of mine named Alistair Rees is a theologian and a sociologist from New Zealand. And New Zealand is an interesting place for us to look to as Canadians, because their journey in right relationship, especially within the church, between Maori and they have a really convenient term of Pakeha, which is non-Maori folks in New Zealand. They've been at this journey of how to sort out right relationship for a lot longer than we have. But there are things that they still bump up against that feel really familiar. Bless you. And so one of the things that Alistair has been pressing into is the idea of identity and covenant. And he argues that covenant is an important way for non-Indigenous peoples to understand our relationship moving forward. In the context of New Zealand, there was a treaty that was formed right at the point of kind of first contact called the Waitangi Treaty, and that he is calling people of faith in particular back to the Waitangi Treaty to say, look, this stands in continuity with our ways of understanding ourselves as covenant people, and this is a covenant that was made in this land that we could then find life and pathways of healing and restoration by walking together according to the treaty. So I had opportunity to hear Alistair present this with a group of Indigenous Christians who were interacting with his idea and his paper. And we had a lively discussion about whether or not there was a comparable treaty here, whether or not Canadians also are called to be treaty people, called to be covenant people in this same sort of a way. And so my friend Terry LeBlanc, who is Mi'kmaq and from then the East Coast, who has the longest period of contact with Europeans as an Indigenous person, says, yes, you are all covered in the peace and friendship treaties that happened in the 1600s when settlers first arrived on these shores and they were invited to come in and to share the bounty of the land together and to live in a good way on this land. He says, you all are covered by that. But for some of my colleagues who are Gitxan and Nadle and from this region of BC took issue with that and said, you can't speak for us, right? We are separate nations. And we didn't make those same agreements, right? And so there are different realities across our land, but they continue to have a lively conversation about whether or not there was welcome when first settlers arrived. And the agreement that there had been welcome at the point of first contact. There was welcome and invitation to share the land in a good way. And even though many of us have come since that welcome, we still inherit and walk in that welcome. It wasn't contested space from the beginning that we were allowed to walk in the land. But whether or not we're all treaty people continues to be a point of contention between us. But we all came to a conclusion that post-Truth and Reconciliation Commission, when the calls to action asked all Canadians to adopt the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as a framework for reconciliation, that in many ways that UN Declaration can and should function as treaty for us. It can and should function as a way to say, here is how we might have and restore right relationship in this land, in this time. But rights and rules and regulations are not the heart of covenant, right? Covenant that probably is most familiar to most of us is the covenant of marriage. That there are rights that come with the covenant of marriage, but if the marriage is primarily about the rights and the exchange of rights and the negotiation of those rights, probably things are not going well, right? That those rights are held in this larger framework of intimacy, and there is the need to respect one another's rights. There is the need to give preferential options to the other in the relationship. That we do best in covenant when we long for the thriving and the prospering of the other in the relationship, and not just the protection of our own rights. Right? And that this might, in fact, be a way in which we can be called into the kind of intimacy that is imagined in the Revelation, as every tongue, tribe, and nation comes into the throne room of God in the fullness of who they are, secure in their identities, together in worship before the Creator. That this, if this is where we're headed, then how might covenant regard for the other, preference for the thriving and prospering of the other, how might that be a pathway, a covenant pathway into healing and wholeness as imagined in the heart of God? How might we be the strongest and best and first advocates for this as people of faith? Because it's fascinating. I'll try not to go down a little tangent on human rights, but sometimes we talk about in the church that human rights, that's the language of nation states. That has nothing to do with us. And when you read the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, it reads like nation state language. It doesn't read like the language of intimacy in relationship. But without so Nicholas Wolterstorff talks about without an identity that understands human beings to be created in the image of God, there's no basis for human rights. And those come out of our own tradition. We've forgotten and lost much of that trajectory of tradition. But this is close to our hearts if we were to recover what that has been. How do we not become the mob that threaten when our identity and our place in the story is threatened, chases Jesus out, but instead holds him near and desires to learn from this one who models rights by giving in love, even to the extreme of death on a cross? How might we enter into covenant, restore covenant relationship with our neighbors who are First Nations in a way that might lead to the flourishing and the thriving of all in this land? What if Jesus was not writing his hometown of Nazareth out of the story, but inviting them instead into new identity in that story? Do they prefer the other in love? Or are they only concerned about their own rights and privileges? Are they afraid to lose it all? Or are they willing, a secure identity held in the love of God, to risk it all? And what about us? How might God be inviting us to root our identity more thoroughly and fully in the person of Christ and his self-giving love? And willing then to risk our identities and our very selves in the love of God.